been around in the great big. Been banging around in the great big city. There's money and the life will never show you no pity.
Danny, I'm back.
Oh, I work hard trying to make my bones. But times have changed and I just got to move. Can't run away, can't run away, can't run. I can't run away, can't run away from the things that I've done.
Good evening and welcome to We Know a Guy Radio, a production of Bear Media Consultants. This is where we talk about everything from organized crime to entertainment. Our guests will include former mobsters and retired lawmen, entertainers, writers, reporters, and successful businessmen and women. You can participate in tonight's show through our chat room or by calling in at 646-478-0982. My name is Denny Griffin, retired investigator and true crime author, and I'm pleased to be joined tonight by Mr. Jonathan Allman, the executive director of the Mob Museum. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Denny.
Well, the Mob Museum opened almost exactly 6 months ago and February 14th of this year. And that just happened to coincide with the anniversary of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. So we wanted to talk to you tonight, Jonathan, and get a little update on what's happened at the museum since February 14th, kind of where you are and at the museum and what your plans are for the future. But first, I just want to raise one point. I've encountered some confusion for people visiting Las Vegas or talking about visiting Las Vegas, and I want to make it clear or have you confirm that there's the Mob Museum, which is downtown in the old courthouse, the old post office building, and there's a separate entity out on the strip of the Tropicana called the Mob Attraction, and that you are two separate entities.
Yeah, that's correct, Denny. We are a 501c3 not-for-profit museum downtown, as you said. We're just a couple blocks off of the Fremont Street Experience, which is a very popular tourist destination in downtown. And as you noted, we occupy the former post office and federal courthouse. So this is, by Las Vegas standards, a very old historic site. It's actually on the National Registry of Historic Places. We expect it's also going to be designated as a federal landmark, of which there are only about 2,500 other buildings with that designation in the United States. We have meticulously restored this building that was first put in service in 1933. So it has a wonderful history in Las Vegas. It's a very modern museum. You know, it was developed with all of the best practices of museums in mind, developed by the same people that created the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. So truly a world-class museum presentation. And we present exhibits in a number of different ways. I mean, we have some wonderful artifacts. You mentioned the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. We have the actual wall from the warehouse where that event took place in Chicago. We have a number of other, very iconic artifacts, but we also have a great deal of multimedia theater presentations and films that were created specially for the museum, as well as interactives. I mean, it's very much a museum where you can do stuff. I mean, you can go and use actual wiretapping tools, listen to tapes of that were used as evidence in actual trials, or use a firearm simulator that's used by law enforcement personnel in the FBI to train. I mean, it's a wonderful interactive experience. And I also, mentioned, Denny, one of the reasons why the site is so historic, that former courthouse, is because it was one of the locations that the Kefauver Committee hearings took place. back in 1950, which ties directly into the history of organized crime. I mean, as you well know, those were U.S. Senate investigative hearings that were intended to root out corruption and organized crime and had a profound effect on how law enforcement pursued these criminals in the years after.
Jonathan, speaking of being on the registry for historical buildings, that, as I recall, really was you had to deal with that when you were renovating the building, right? I mean, you virtually, I understand, couldn't pound a nail or something without making sure everything was approved for whatever you wanted to do to that building.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the building was surplus from the federal government to the city of Las Vegas, which then oversaw, along with the museum's board, the construction of, and really, it's, you know, we think about it in two phases. Really, it's the rehabilitation of the building itself, and then the fabrication and installation of the exhibits. But to maintain that historic designation, we were required to work very closely with the National Park Service, make certain that all of the plans were approved. And it, you know, it's real interesting when you take a facility like this. It has, the building itself has a certain historic designation, but then the spaces within the building have different levels of historical significance. So areas like the courtroom, for example, have the highest degree of historic significance and had to be restored with, remarkable precision. And then there were restrictions of the degree to which we could create the thematic, exhibit environments in those spaces. So some areas of the building we had much more latitude than others.
And now, how tough was it or easy was it to get these artifacts? Did people, was it fairly easy? Did people really want to cooperate and donate or provide artifacts for the museum?
It's been a really interesting process. I mean, as we've now that we're open, the opening of the museum has really opened the floodgates in terms of people reaching out to us and telling us that they have interesting objects that they'd like to. Often they're looking to sell them, but many times we're successful in having people donate them to us because, they do get a charitable write-off when they do that, and they're also doing it for a good cause. I mean, we're a nonprofit with an educational mission. But it's been a really interesting process. I mean, some things just fell into our laps, and certainly a great deal of help we received were from law enforcement agencies that I think were quite proud of the opportunity to be able to showcase some of their history. But it's, every piece has had a story. This was a very new type of entity, when we came on the scene. So so a number of objects we've secured have been leased. And I think that's, partly in due to, people not really knowing what to expect.
Jonathan, we've just been joined by my friend and co-host, Andrew DiDonato. Andrew.
Hey, Jonathan, Andrew, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, Andrew?
Good, good, good. Everything's fine. Sorry for running late, guys. I believe it or not, I had a traffic incident. I had a bad time a whole bit, but I'll tell you all about it in a little while. Hope everybody's good.
hope you're
okay.
All right.
I'm good. Don't worry about it. I'm good.
We've just been talking a little bit about the museum and that celebrating its 6-month anniversary. Actually, yesterday was the 6-month anniversary. Jonathan, I attended the opening of the museum, and it was really a great experience, and got to go through the building. I don't know if there's been any changes made since then, but very impressive. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there were 3 floors of exhibits. And I'm under the impression that you could spend, I'm talking about a visitor to the museum, could easily spend 3 or 4 hours there. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Oh, easily. And in fact, that's one of the comments we get is about, you know, people being awestruck by the amount of information, by the amount of, you know, the number, you know, sheer volume of exhibits and literally, if you were to do every interactive, watch every film, read every label, it would take you several days to do it all. You just can't do it all in one visit. And I think that's been part of our success. I mean, the visitor reaction has been outstanding. I mean, it's, you know, we're really very pleased and proud of that. Not that we don't continue to do work to refine the exhibits. I mean, I think, Denny, if you came back, you would see that we've added some really interesting pieces. You know, we have this great exhibit that wasn't out there on opening day where it's actually a video audio recording booth where people can leave their own personal stories of, you know, how they've been impacted by organized crime or stories or experiences they've had with law enforcement, and that we're able to then repurpose those and share them with other guests. I mean, it's, you know, it's really neat little improvements like that we've made since we've been open, adding to the exhibits and helping and refining some of the presentations. But, you know, as you noted, it is three floors of exhibits. When you can go at whatever pace and go back and forth as you like. It's, you know, you're not forced to go a certain way, but you are encouraged to go through it because, you know, from top to bottom, because it's arranged chronologically. You know, you go up to the third floor and it starts off at the turn of the 20th century, and it's very much a story of how organized crime took root in America. You know, I mean, this is very much a, you know, a story of it's an immigrant story. You know, it starts off with, you know, Irish, Italian, Jewish immigrants, and talks about the social conditions that caused organized crime to fester, you know, in the, you know, early 20th century. And, you know, we also like to say, I mean, this is very much equal opportunity organized crime. By the time you get to the, you know, contemporary periods on the lower floor, you know, we're talking internationally, you know, where organized crime persists today, and it's about Russian organized crime, for example. It's not, you know, this is not all about, you know, one particular ethnic group.
Andrew, yes. You've been to the museum. From a former mobster's perspective, what do you think of it, looking at it through from your background and experience?
Well, you know what? It was funny because the first time that I walked through there, I was walking through the halls with a friend of mine whose father was a mobster as well. He was a high-ranking mobster. And my friend had no idea that his father was portrayed in the museum. And I looked at his face, and I could see in his face the shock that he couldn't believe that his father was on the wall there. And there were so many other people there that I knew. And, you know, I've had, you know, business dealings with, or people that I have met during my life within organized crime circles. And I remember walking through the halls there saying, I remember when that happened. I know a case that case was on. There were some pictures there from a trial that I actually testified on. And I seen some of the photos from there, and I was like, oh, my God, I remember that photo like it was yesterday. And and like Jonathan just said, there's so many interactive things to do there. And, you know, you can learn about the Chicago outfit, of course, the five families in New York. You get a little glimpse into organized crime throughout the world, not just in the United States. So, you know, I mean, it's a great learning experience, you know, and somebody like me who grew up around this and it's all I knew throughout my whole life, it's like seeing your whole surroundings in one building of everything you've ever been touched with or anything you came across, and then some new things that I didn't know about that was going on in you know, throughout the world. And it's very, very interesting, and I love going there. I mean, I go there, you know, when I go back and forth to, you know, to Vegas, it's one of my spots for sure. But and Johnson treats me very well. Johnson's a gentleman.
Yeah. Well, you're very kind, Andrew.
He certainly is. Jonathan, let me just ask you, what are the ticket prices for to get in the museum?
Yeah, the single highest adult ticket price is $18. Now, we then discount for members of military, for seniors, law enforcement, other You have student groups. And then, you know, for Nevada residents, it's $10.
So for relatively, absolutely, for relatively little money, and then just you know, you can get several hours of entertainment and education for a pretty small fee.
And we have very reasonably priced memberships as well. So we've found that, you know, people that are really, you know, aficionados of this subject matter, you know, they'll come back, you know, time and time again. And it's pretty amazing to see.
Oh, without question, now, because, you know, go ahead, Dennis.
I was just going to say, I don't know what you folks had in mind as far as an attendance figure, that, and I'm not going to ask for any specific numbers, but just in general, generally speaking, are you so far, after 6 months, satisfied with the response you're getting from the public and the attendance?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you open a new museum, and, you know, you never truly know what to expect. And it's also, you know, like everything else, and particularly in Las Vegas, it's dependent on large part to tourism and how, you know, tourism to the, you know, to the city is going overall. So we're subject, like every other business, to the ebbs and flows, you know, based on what's going on in the environment and the economy. But we're real happy with how we're doing. I mean, we've, you know, since we've opened, we've surpassed the 100,000 guest mark. You know, that's a lot of people. And
in 6 months,
where we're,
yes,
yeah, and we're, you know, not only is it a lot of people, but it's a lot of happy people. I mean, we've, our guest comments, you know, 96 or 97% of the people that come through here rate us as being good or excellent in terms of an experience. You know, we get amazing reviews on Yelp and TripAdvisor and on Facebook. So, you know, we know we have a stellar product. And we also know right now, you know, we're kind of on the edge down in downtown Las Vegas. I mean, you guys know our site. We're a short walk from the Fremont Street Experience, so it's easy enough for people to get to us. We don't have a lot of traffic down here right now. I mean, this is, you know, part of the reason why the city got behind this was to help revitalize and stimulate some of the, you know, some of the business development in the area. And we got a casino property, the Downtown Grand, which used to be the Lady Luck, that's right across the street and is in, it's not open right now because it's being renovated. We know next year that place, you know, we're going to have a 1,400-person casino hotel property, you know, across the street from us. That's 1,400 rooms, I'm talking. You know, it's a much bigger casino. Zappos is moving into the old city hall on the other side of our property. You know, this whole area is going through a transformation. So we know that that in the, you know, the next couple of years, I mean, you know, we're going to see, you know, an uptick, you know, in the traffic around here, and attendance is only going to go up. So we're very excited.
Yeah, you, the museum, really, the timing was actually perfect, wasn't it? I mean, you're getting in there when there's an effort underway, and, of course, you're part of it to revitalize that now.
Yeah, I mean, we're, you know, we like to think that we're, you know, we're helping to lead that effort. I mean, it's, you know, we've gotten tremendous press outside of, you know, within and outside of Las Vegas. I mean, we've, you know, we've been getting these, you know, wonderful best of awards. You know, one of the, you know, we just got a best of Nevada award as a museum. We've gotten, you know, some best of attraction awards from the, from Las Vegas publications. But we've also been on national lists. I mean, we've hit the Travel and Leisure Best Reasons, New Attractions for Las Vegas. You know, CNN's Go site had a similar survey. So, you know, we're proud of the fact that we're helping, you know, to put downtown Las Vegas, you know, more top of mind with tourists and visitors, and cause people to come stay and visit down here.
And the key word when we were talking about the attendance was happy. There's nothing like a satisfied customer.
Well, you're absolutely right there. And I think, you know, and it's so important in the museum world, too, because you're advancing an educational mission. I mean, we are educating people when they come here. We're celebrating the efforts of law enforcement. We're telling important parts of our city's history as well as the country's history. But at the same time, people are getting great entertainment value out of it. So it's, you know, it's almost like they're learning without really, you know, feeling like they're learning. I mean, it's,
yeah,
you know, it's exactly what you try to, yeah.
It comes unexpectedly. I did the book signing there not too long ago, and everybody would come up to me, of course, you know, like you said, they're organized crime aficionados and they're followers of all different genres from whether it be Chicago or New York. And everybody who came through there said, well, you know, I didn't know X, Y, and Z. You know, I seen that. I didn't know that that guy was involved on that case or during that time period. A lot of people were kind of like shocked. So everybody picks up a little bit of something from it. And as we're sitting there doing the signing, we got everybody coming out, and I would ask people, and some people come through and just, you could see it in their faces. One lady came up to me. She was white-knuckled. She was like, oh, my God. She was like, she goes, that was just an experience and a half. I says, and I looked at it, and I was like, I said, so did you enjoy it? She goes, I enjoyed it very much. She says, but it just, she goes, it got overwhelming. She, there was just so much to absorb, she says. And then when they come to that end room where they have, like, where they show how the Hollywood started to depict mobsters in movies and stuff like that, such as movies like Casino and stuff like that. And she was like, oh, my God. You know, and then there were some things about Frank Collada being involved in the movie and, you know, his case being where, you know, he reenacted one of the crimes he actually committed on screen. And, you know, that itself is a learning lesson for somebody. It's a piece of history. So I can't, you know, I think you hit it right on the head. You know, people don't expect to learn. They expect to just see, you know, mobsters and machine guns and all this, but they walk out knowing a lot more than they did before they walked in.
Well, I appreciate that, Andrew. I'll tell you, one of the things, too, that I think makes this such a great and unique experience is people like yourselves. I mean, I think we have strived to make this as authentic an experience as possible. I mean, it's all factually based. We don't glamorize or sensationalize the past. You know, it's telling the facts. It's presenting in a way in which people can get real close to the artifacts and the objects. But it's also presenting the people. I mean, and you can't get any more authentic than presenting, you know, giving people an opportunity to engage with someone like yourself who was in the life and can tell firsthand the stories. And, you know, it's, you know, just brings it to a whole nother level.
No, without a doubt. And, you know, now that I'm seeing, you know, I get a lot of, you know, friends of mine who, you know, who moved on from the life and they live, you know, throughout the country. And I get people calling me all the time. And it's like, they all have a question about the museum in some sort of way because they're all involved in organized crime circles as well. So just that, it's like, it piques their interest to know what's in there. It's like, they keep asking me, so what else do they have in there? And I said, listen, just make the trip. You're going to make a trip someday anyway, yeah. Go on vacation. Stop in, make a trip. I'll introduce you around. And in this way, if you wanted to do something afterwards to, you know, speak to the people or do something like that. But it's so funny how everybody's so interested to find out what kind of exhibits are in there. And, you know, I can only explain it to a certain extent, but you got to really live it for yourself and actually go and see it.
Jonathan, in addition to the three floors of exhibits, and I guess it was all impressive to me, but I found that the courtroom to be awesome. I mean, it's, you walk in there, and I could almost think I was going to see Senator Kefauver walk in at any moment. You know, I mean, that it's just an awesome feeling for me as a history buff of organized crime to be in that facility in that setting.
Yeah, you know, we're just thrilled with how that turned out. I mean, that's really the crown jewel of the museum, that space. And it is, you know, you talk about authenticity. I mean, here is one of the locations. The Kefauver Committee hearings took place in 14 cities around the country. And that's not a lot of places. It's 14 cities. One of them was Las Vegas, and that hearing in Las Vegas took place right in that very courtroom. And I think, you know, people, people nowadays don't necessarily appreciate how significant of an event that was, those hearings. I mean, these were U.S. Senate investigative hearings that took place a few years before the McCarthy hearings. You know, as everybody remembers, those were, you know, the hearings into, you know, about communism. It was the Crofer Committee hearings that set the precedent for these very televised public hearings. And it was at a time in the country when TVs were just becoming mainstream. I mean, about half the households in the United States had TVs. And the U.S. population at the time was about 150 million people. It's estimated that as many as 30 million people watched these hearings. More people watched these hearings than watched, you know, the 1951 World Series. I mean, it was truly a national phenomenon. I mean, you know, you read the Time magazine accounts of what was going on back then, and literally, you know, businesses would shut down when the hearings were on because people would go gather in stores or bars or people's homes to watch. And it was the first time that people really got a chance to see these very seedy, you know, criminal characters, you know, firsthand, to be able to see them right there and, you know, answering these questions. And it had, you know, such a profound effect, not only nationally, but specifically for how Las Vegas ended up evolving, because on the heels of these hearings, there was such a backlash. You know, other states around the country that were considering legalizing gambling as a result of these hearings chose not to, which made Las Vegas just all the more attractive to that criminal element and really helped define the way in which Las Vegas evolved, you know, in the years to come. So, it's, you know, in terms of the subject matter of the museum, you know, it really, you know, people wonder, well, why would you take this building and create a museum about organized crime and law enforcement? It actually, you know, it could not make more sense.
Yeah, and in addition to the exhibit areas where, you know, the attendees can come in and browse at their leisure and go through, the museum is doing other things, right? I mean, I believe they're now available to be booked for private events, and the museum itself has different events open. I know you got some like classroom space and so forth down in the basement. So tell us about some of the other things that happen at the museum.
Yeah, we absolutely do private events. What we're also starting to focus a great deal of attention on is creating a programming calendar so that we can, you know, it's difficult to change out your exhibits, but we can certainly do other things that, you know, make this a more dynamic location, so give people a reason, particularly members, to come back time and time again, and also to kind of, you know, address, you know, be able to delve deeper into the topics. You know, address some of the things that we weren't able to do with our, you know, limited space with the exhibits. So, you know, one of the things that we're really excited about is we're creating and we're launching a speaker series this fall. We call it our Inside Story Speaker Season series, and it's, we have a speaker coming in, you know, one in September, one in October, and one in November. And now we've, you know, it's not unusual for us to have guest speakers here, but this particular series, I mean, we're talking about, you know, some of, you know, the foremost experts in their discipline. Now, the first one in September is Jack Garcia, who is one of the most successful undercover FBI agents, you know, ever. I mean, this is a guy that infiltrated the Gambino crime family. He had, you know, several identities over his time as an undercover agent, and was involved in more than 100 operations in his career. And he was, you know, when he went into the undercover in the Gambino crime family, he was so successful that, you know, and they've got this on wiretaps, that he was going to be made, and he got so close to being made, and it was, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that he ended up getting into a situation where his superiors felt like his cover was, you know, close to being compromised and it was getting too dangerous, and, you know, he got pulled out. He would have been the only FBI agent ever to have gotten made. And he was actually, you know, quite angry about the fact that his superiors ended his assignment before he was able to achieve that, that, you know, kind of notoriety there. But he has amazing stories to tell. You know, then the next guy we got in October, so now we've gone from, you know, amazing FBI undercover agent. Now we got an academic, this fellow, Dr. Mark Galeotti. He is a clinical professor from New York University, and he is actually the chair of their Center for Global Affairs. He's a specialist in Russia, modern Russia, and actually in the course of his field work, you know, as he was, you know, years ago, as he was doing field work about, you know, the former Soviet Union, you know, he encountered this whole new generation of gangsters, you know, these gangsters that were, you know, kind of, you know, as he likes to say, carving out their, you know, their positions within, you know, what was this, you know, decaying, you know, former Soviet Union. And he was the first, you know, one of the first, you know, Western academics, you know, to realize that this was going to become a real security concern. And in fact, at the time, you know, Dr. Galeotti was teaching in the UK. He was at a very large university in the UK called Keele University. And he became the founding director of its Organized Russian and Eurasian Crime Research Unit, which is the only such specialized center in all of Europe. Then he came to the United States, and he continues to do, you know, he's a renowned expert in transnational organized crime, particularly Russian mob. And he's going to tell us, you know, speak to us about our guests about how the Russian mob has evolved and how it has, you know, what kind of presence it has in America, how it's impacting us here. And then the third speaker we got in November is G. Robert Blakey. And anybody that is, you know, a real, you know, that really understands the history of organized crime will know of Bob Blakey for a number of reasons. I mean, he's currently a law professor at Notre Dame, but he's got a number of really important achievements. One is that he essentially drafted the RICO Act. So,
yep.
You know, that, you know, Andrew, I'm sure you've got to be very familiar with RICO.
Very familiar.
No offense to nothing. So he's was, you know, essentially the author of RICO, very clued into, you know, the rise of organized crime, was, you know, very involved in the aftermath of Appalachian. He's considered a wiretapping expert. You know, he drafted many of the statutes about wiretapping. And then he was also the staff director of the U.S. House Select Committee on Assassinations that was created to investigate, in particular, the assassination of JFK. And Blakey's gone on record. You know, he's someone that you know, has been quite clear about his belief that that organized crime was very involved in the plot to assassinate JFK. So, you know, I mean, I think, you know, extremely compelling subject, you know, in so many different ways.
That very awesome lineup you got, and I'll tell you that, well, I'd like to hear all three of them, and I know Jack Garcia personally. I've had the pleasure of actually talking with him on the phone, and he's been a guest on one of our shows, and Andrew knows him quite well. I'll let Andrew
One of my very dear friends, me and Jack. It's so funny that when people ask me, you know, they would never think it. You know, I always make a joke about it. I say, you know, 15 years ago, I would have took 2 buses, a plane, a submarine to get away from him, and now he's one of my best friends.
That is funny.
You know, so, it is, and he's a hell of a nice guy. Exactly.
Yeah,
it shows how things go full circle.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you something. I mean, you can understand why he was so successful as an undercover agent, just, you know, based on his charisma. I mean, he's just got a gift for putting you at ease, getting you to trust him, and he's just such a likable guy and such a dynamic speaker. I mean, he's got, you know, so many fantastic stories to tell. I mean, I cannot be more excited about what, you know, that presentation.
Jonathan, just a thought. I'm not going to be in town, unfortunately, in September. But will you guys tape or will there be some way to get an audio or video of these things? Are you going to tape them somehow or no?
Yeah, we're definitely videotaping them. You know, this is still new to us, but we'd like to see how we can make them into podcasts and make them available to people. I mean, I think it's they're going to be that good.
And I do want to mention, too, you mentioned that Jack had several aliases after he wrote a book called The Making of Jack Falcone. That was we were just talking about how he almost became a made man, and that was one of the aliases, and that became a New York Times bestseller. So he's the real deal.
You know, he was an FBI agent for 26 years, but he was undercover for 24 years straight. How's that? That's
Gotta
be a real pressure job right there.
I can't even imagine. And it's, you know, we have this great exhibit of at the museum of all of the tools that he used. I mean, you know, and it's just astounding to look at. You know, and again, you think about the time period. I mean, we're all used to, you know, nowadays with our smartphones and our iPods, you know, all of our little, you know, recording devices are so small. You go and look at, you know, the wire that he was wearing and the cassette recorder, you know, that he was carrying around on his person on a daily basis, you know, as he's, you know, undercover, you know, with, you know, with all these people around him that if they knew the truth, you know, he'd be a dead man. It's unfathomable. I mean, and he tells the story of how he used to go and, you know, he'd meet his handler in Home Depot, you know, several times a day to go exchange cassettes, you know, to, you know, do a drop of what he had learned that day. And it's just, I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, the pressure and stress. Yeah, the courage it requires, extraordinary. He's a real hero.
And to be able to do that for 20-some years, I mean, that's that's incredible.
No, it's a great story. It really is. Jack has a great story. And the good thing about Jack is he also, you know, he doesn't stop there. I mean, still, even to this day, you know, he likes to, you know, he shares all his information. He's still being used today, you know, for intelligence purposes, of course, with the FBI, even though he's retired. And, you know, he just got a tremendous knowledge of the life. And, you know, when me and Jack became friends over the years, we started to realize how many people, you know, we both were in their company, me for another purpose, of course, but him as well. And then we both started to, you know, I had my opinion of this person and how they carried themselves. And then I seen how Jack's opinion was because he was on the other side. And it was quite amazing to see the things that, how he depicted somebody as opposed to how I depicted them as my friends over the years. It was that was interesting enough.
That's fascinating. I hope, Andrew, it'd be great to get you out here, you know, when we have that in September.
No. Listen, as a matter of fact, it would be my pleasure. I mean, of course, my door is always open for you, John. I mean, you've been so good to us. You know, whatever I could do, you know, you just ask and we'll make sure we get it done. As far as Jack is concerned, we did speak about that. And I told him that if there's anything he needs from me before he comes out there by you, to just ask me, and I could help. I could help him 100% because, you know, Jack infiltrated the crime family I was involved in. You know, and the guys that, you know, he infiltrated, you know, Greg DePalma and those guys out of the Bronx faction. You know, I was really close with one or two of the guys from the Bronx faction over the years, and you know, I was already in the program when this was going on, but I can't begin to tell you how much I laughed when I found out what you said earlier, how they were looking to straighten him out. I mean, he had them so blinded by the money he was bringing in that they didn't see past the dollar bill. And it just goes to show you how organized crime works. As long as you're making that almighty dollar, everything else could be, you know, forgotten about or overlooked. And that's the magic trick he pulled.
It is a remarkable story, you know. I mean, and this guy, you know, he's not an inconspicuous man either. I mean, he's a very imposing figure.
He's
a guy you notice. He's a very large guy. He's also, you know, it's interesting, you know, his background, you know, he was born in Cuba. I mean, he came to the United States when he was a school kid. You know, I think he was, something like 8 or 9 or 10 years old. I mean, he was a young kid, grew up in the Bronx. But it's not like, you know, I mean, he had to learn so much about, you know, the lingo, you know, use the right terminology, the right, you know, the right inflection when he speak, you know, all the sorts of things that you know, as Andrew, as you know so well, could be, you know, could make someone scratch their head if you made the slightest mistake.
Oh, no, without a doubt. You know, you don't, that's 100% true. You don't know what a guy is going to see within your personality that tips him off that you're not authentic. So you can never tell. So he went to something what he called mob school before he started to infiltrate the family. He sat down with an Italian-American from the Bronx and actually went through all the lingo with the street slang for certain things and how to go about talking about foods and everything, because he tried to relate, because he's a big man, so he related a lot of things to foods and stuff like that, and then he started to gain his confidence slowly but surely. But, and you know what the fascinating thing is, Jonathan, is that he's just one. Now, look at this. We spoke about Jack for the last few minutes. He's just one of the hundreds and hundreds of exhibits you got there. This is just one guy. So look how fascinating his life is. Now you go and the hundreds of people you got depicted within that museum, they could keep you busy for days. You know, it really can, you know.
Point.
Well, it's the truth. Even me, I'm, you know, I've been in the life, I've been around the most notorious guys in the country. And basically, I still walk through there, and I learn things walking through there. You know, things, you know, you know, pretty much I knew my surroundings. I knew about everything I had to know about New York and who we dealt with. But I've learned other things in there that, you know, were all new to me. So if I can learn in there, anybody can learn in there, you know?
We need to get your picture to put up on the wall too, Andrew.
Well, Dennis has it. As a matter of fact, Jack Garcia got it for me. You know, it was hard getting some photos throughout the years through some of the cases I was involved in. So, you know, once these cases are over and everybody goes on, everybody moves on, it's hard to reach out to somebody to try to get some photos that would still be active. But I did get my hand on a few, so I'll have Dennis or somebody else close to me to get them to you ASAP, I promise.
Yeah, very good. Very good.
Jonathan, well, you know, we've been talking about some of your upcoming events and so forth. This might be a good time to have you tell us, does the museum have a website where people could go to get more information or purchase tickets and so forth?
Absolutely. It's real easy. It's the mobmuseum.org. Very straightforward site, you know, gives, and in fact, you know, not only can you get information about upcoming events, about the exhibits, about ticket prices and all that, but there's some great content on this site. I mean, I tell you, you go, you know, we have a little blog that we run that we do different features, you know, pretty much each month, you know, that they're great stories. I mean, whether it's, you know, it's the former mayor of Las Vegas, Oscar Goodman, who was was a very famous defense attorney for reputed mobsters before he became the mayor. You know, there's some great stories up there about him. We've got some great accounts from, you know, the special agent in charge for the tri-state region down here of the IRS, you know, talking about, you know, ways in which organized crime has been combated through the IRS and finding, you know, people having violated or evaded taxes. There's a great little a blog that's up there now that's a feature that is the daughter of Vinny the Chin, you know, and she's, you know, all of her insights. I mean, it's, you know, great stuff up there. So, and you can shop at the store, a lot of information, a lot of great stuff you can do on the website.
And make sure that it is .org, not .com, right?
Yeah, that's right. Hopefully, if you accidentally put in .com, it'll still get to the right place. But
hey,
.org.
I got a funny story for you.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who was also an organized crime activity, and he was part of the Gambino crime family himself. Well, he's in the auto industry now. And just about a week ago, he goes to an auction, and he finds a van that he wants, not knowing what's inside the van or anything. And he opens up the van, and to his surprise, it used to be a surveillance van for one of the, he bought it at a police auction at one of the police departments in the United States. And it still had all the monitors, all the VCR, still with tape inside it. It's fully active, but it was from years ago. And the truck is from 1992 and still only had like 4,500 miles on it. And he called me up laughing. He goes, imagine of all the people in the world to buy this van, it would be me. And we had such a kick at it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I told him, I says, it still had tape inside that you could actually, but it was VCR tape, that's how old it was, of surveillance that law enforcement was using the truck for.
Oh, that's great.
Exactly. It was funny to tell the stories.
Does he want to get rid of it?
Well, as a matter of fact, he does, but I didn't know. I told him, I says, I don't know. I says, you know, I want to see what kind of significance it has. Dennis was the first one who told me. He said, well, what kind of significance does it have? So I asked him, and he sent me, like, all the information from it. It was used in New York, actually, for surveillance in one of the upstate communities that happens to have one of the most, I forget statistic-wise, but it was, like, one of the most crime-ridden areas in the United States. And I guess they were using it for whatever, but I could always ask him and see, you know, what it is. I know he still has it because that's not something that you could sell every day. That's something that's a specific item that somebody would have to do. And so I would definitely speak to him for you for sure, and I could always put you in contact with him. That's not a problem. But that would be something where people could actually do that, and if everything is in working order, like he says it is, then you could probably use that where people could actually hear the surveillance, or you could have surveillance of them at the museum and then show them at the end. It might be a nice artifact. I don't know. I'll see. I'll look into it for you.
Absolutely. That'd be a lot of fun. You know, I don't know if I told you or if you got a chance to see while you were out here that we have one of John Gotti's cars.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it at the opening. Yeah, I've seen it. I thought that was very nice. It was a Jaguar, correct?
Jaguar convertible. It's a sporty little thing. It's not the easiest thing to maintain, but
no, without a doubt. But that's definitely a piece of history. Let's face it. I mean, when you think about John and you think about, you know, his legacy behind, he's one of the most popular organized crime figures of all time. I mean, him, Al Capone, stuff like that. So that's definitely a piece of history right there.
A perfect car for him. I mean, a lot of flash. It's a very pretty car. Very pretty. Yeah.
But no one else. Last time I was there, I seen that you had a few prison buses at the location. Do you use them for, like, just to have people go and take a look at what the prison buses look like, or are they just, like, Is it part of the museum activity? We don't own them.
We got a, but there was someone in the area that had these authentic prison buses, and we said, why not? Let's let people, go on and have a look for themselves. And it's, that'll make you think. I mean, you get on these buses and you see, it's got all the scratched in graffiti, that these, that these prisoners use with their handcuffs, and some of the contraband that was found, on the prisoners on these buses. And, it's a little eerie. I mean, there's, they got special compartments for the particularly dangerous or the deranged criminals. And, it's not a bad thing, particularly for, younger kids, you go in there and you, I'm not talking about real young kids, but,
at the danger zone age. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it makes you think.
That's a good deterrent because, and then what you should do, of course you got it all down pat over there, but what you do in situations like that, you make a little tour, you bring teenagers in there, whatever, and you show them the bus and let them sit on it for a while, and then every kid who sits on that bus or anything, like you said, it's going to be intimidating. And then once they sit on it, they're going to realize. Yeah.
It's like one of those, scared straight programs,
No, that definitely does work. I mean, because, listen, I drove on too many of those buses, John. I can tell you, I drove on the state ones, the federal ones, and believe me, it's not pretty at all. It's not at all, because the saddest part of that whole trip is sitting inside that bus knowing that you're not going to be home for years and years, and everything you see outside that window is just a fantasy at that point.
I can't even imagine.
It's a shame that, that I lived through it, but basically, at least, when the time comes to do speak to young kids or something like that, at least we can speak from experience and let them know, hey, listen, you might just see an empty truck and bus in a parking lot, but there's a lot more significance to it than that. Once you're in this bus and you're going to a location, your whole life is changing, So,
Andrew, man, it's
humbling.
It's,
a little wake up
call.
Yeah, without
a
doubt.
A lot of good came out of it, man.
No, without a doubt it did, and you know what? And that's the whole idea. The whole idea is, to make the negative into a positive. And, it's like having friends like Jack and people like that who, who seen that we tried to make the change and what we're trying to do, and they help you along because, being that they're on the other side and they see the efforts that we're making is part of the things that we did with the book. When we wrote the book, me and Dennis, we wrote it with that in mind, to show people that although as I was going through all these changes in the life, that I was thinking that I was doing it for one thing, but my life was actually taking a whole different turn. And it's learning from that, That's what makes a guy wise, when he can learn from somebody else's mistakes. So hopefully somebody will, read it, and that's what the whole story was about.
And, I was just listening to Andrew talk, and we were talking about Jack Garcia, and it was really... for your grand opening, I mentioned I was there the night before, I believe it was, and it was amazing to see the former mobsters mingling with the former lawmen. I mean, like Andrew was saying, years ago you'd have taken, two buses, a train, and a submarine to get away from these people, and all of a sudden they're standing together or sitting together, giggling or not giggling, but laughing and having an enjoyable time. And who'd have thunk?
I tell you, Denny, one of the most fascinating things about this work has been, the whole psychology of all of this. I mean, when you got a guy like, Frank Collada, with Dennis Arnoldy, and Dennis, the guy that, the law enforcement agent that brought him down, and, here, here they're best friends. I mean, they're, you know, you would never, it just, it's so hard to, you know, particularly for someone like myself that's never actually been, you know, been involved, you know, directly as, you know, on either side, you know, to understand how, you know, these folks can develop, you know, a respect or a friendship or, and relationships, you know, it's, you know, it's just fascinating, you know, what it says about the human psyche.
Well, what it comes down to, Jonathan, we're human, number one. Number two, it was just a job. It was a job on both sides. The guy who's in the street guy, it's his job. His job is to wake up every morning. If he's part of a crime family, his job is to earn as much money he can. And the law enforcement guy, his job is to catch that guy. So there's a mutual respect there to start with, because you have to respect your opposition. If you don't, you're in for a real, real bad time. You have to. You have to. That'll keep you more sharp than ever. And then after that, over the years past, you realize when you're looking to change your life and they see you're being true about it, they'll ingratiate you with your friendships and you can share stories and realize that, hey, you had your job, I had mine, and we moved on. And, you know, thank God that it had not a happy ending, but a proper ending where, you know, everybody's on the right side of the law now.
What's that line out of The Godfather? It was so famous. Nothing personal, strictly business. Well, that's
exactly
true.
Exactly. It is. It's true. And that's exactly what it is.
I guess, you know, allegiances change too. I guess. I mean, you look at Frank and Dennis. You know, I mean, Frank. You know, once Frank flipped, you know, he became so dependent on Dennis, and you know, and I suppose from Dennis's perspective too. You know, he starts to. You know, that dependency can, you know, turns into, you know, legitimate care and concern. So.
Yeah, it does. You know, that's your lifeline. When you turn on the only life that you know, and your only ally at this point is your handler, who in Frank's case was Dennis, and as long as Dennis treats you honestly and fairly, which he did, then you build that trust. He gained that trust, and he earned that trust. So right away, Frank is going to ingratiate him with his, you know, with his trust, and that's how over the years they had a mutual respect for one another. So that's how it works.
Lifeline, it's a very good description, because that's virtually what Dennis ended up being for Frank after he flipped his lifeline. Anything Frank needed or needed for his family and stuff, Dennis was the guy, he was the go-to guy.
And it's not an easy situation, because I've been in it myself, and, you know, you're putting your hands in someone who was tracking you down, and you have to just let go. You know, being in the street your whole life, like Frank was, or like I was, or the next guy was, it's like, trust is always a thing. You know, you don't trust anybody. You know that, you know, the only person you could trust is the guy who shaves your face in the mirror, and that's you. So to win that trust over... To win that trust over is a very, very big step. But little by little, it does happen. And thank God there was a decent ending on that page. And I was fortunate enough to have a similar situation. So, you know, I thank God for that.
Jonathan, we're running out of time real quick here. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about the museum? Any other, you know, upcoming events or plans for the future for the museum?
You know, I just... You know, just reiterate again, I mean, the speaker series is going to be tremendous. Tickets are going to go on sale next week. People should be checking our website for that. I mean, I actually giving you guys a scoop talking about it now. I don't think the press release is going out until tomorrow. And otherwise, you know, we're going to continue to add other special events, and the museum is just a phenomenal experience. So, right, you know, real easy to get to downtown Las Vegas. Just steps from the Fremont Street Experience. You know, just people just need to come out and see it for themselves.
Not only that, they never know who they're going to meet there. They never know who you're going to meet there. You can meet a law enforcement guy. You never know. That's the beauty of it. You know what I mean? That's the beauty of it.
Absolutely.
So don't forget the mobmuseum.org and check it out and check the content, as Jonathan said, and also check the events and the ticket info. And we're out of time, fellas. The hour flew by. Jonathan, thanks so much for being on the show tonight, and I hope you'll come back again with some additional updates for us.
Anytime, guys. I really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure.
Well, have a good night,
thanks,
Jonathan.
Everyone,
good
for listening. And please join us on September 19th for another installment of We Know a Guy Radio. And don't forget to check out BearMediaConsultants.com, the place to go if you want to get connected. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.
Good night, Andrew. Good night, Jonathan.
Good night, guys. Thanks a lot.